Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer DJ Swivel Jordan Young. First of all, there's a streaming price war that's happening. Yes, we knew it was going to happen sooner or later, and now we're in the middle of it. Amazon is now giving away 4 free months if you subscribe to Amazon Music. Now, it's kind of standard for 3 months, but 4 months is really setting a precedent, and they're trying really hard to get in the business and get in the business really strongly. Now, the other streaming services have responded. Spotify has gone back to its 3 months for 99-cent deal, which is really great. Apple Music, of course, always has a 3-month free introduction, as Google Play Music does as well. So, in fact, we're seeing this trend towards lots of free music at first to entice someone into the streaming world, and then hopefully they'll pay later. That being said, studies have shown that between 20 and 25% of people that stream for free actually hop between services just so they can do it for free. And a lot of times what they'll do is they'll sign up with a brand new email address in order to get that 3 months for free. Now, you have to wonder, at some point in time, it becomes a pain doing it and you run out of email addresses. So hopefully at that point, they'll stop and actually be converted into a real buyer at $9.99 a month. We'll see how that works. That's the ultimate goal. And there's more and more people that are actually signing up, subscribing, and paying for the service. Probably not as much as the record labels and artists and publishers would like, but it's getting there. And I think we're going to find at the end of the year, this has been a great year for streaming music and a great year for the music business in general. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my new Music Producer Formula course, as well as my other online video courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com. For more on my music industry and music production blogs, just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, where you can also read excerpts from my books. Now, here's something that's interesting. This year is the 50th anniversary of the SM58. Yes, 50 years ago, the SM58 came out, preceded the year before by the SM57. And there's a lot of very interesting things in the history. One of the things that I find most interesting is the fact that they haven't changed it in 50 years at all. The beta series, when it came out, was an attempt to actually update it, upgrade it. But that being said, the original SM57, SM58 have not changed at all in 50 years, which is pretty amazing. Now, the fact of the matter is, when it first came out, it was intended for television studios. And that's why it's called SM57 or SM58. SM stands for Studio Mic. That's also the reason for the color, so there'd be no reflections at all. And it's also the reason why there's no on-off switch, which all Shure mics had up until that point. Now, of course, all Shure mics also were bright and shiny and not very good for the studio. That being said, Electrovoice kind of had the television studio market pretty much sewn up. And the big problem was that Shure could not crack the market with the SM series. Couldn't do it. So by 1970, they were just about to kill it off. Yes, everyone's favorite microphone might have gone by the wayside, except for one sales manager who, in a last-ditch effort, went to Las Vegas and convinced the sound engineers of Vegas shows to give it a try. And kind of the rest is history after that. Now, another thing about the SM57, SM58 is they're really identical microphones. There's nothing different between them except for the ball filter on the SM58, but internally, it's exactly the same microphone. I was just trying to put a pop filter on and keep the vocal a little ways away, a few inches away from the diaphragm in order to get their arms around the plosives. And of course, that does work very well. One of the reasons why people use the SM57 in the studio on a snare drum and why it's become pretty much the standard is because of the high SPL limit. It will take anywhere between 150 to 180 dB SPL. And that's one of the few microphones that doesn't crack up on a snare when you use it. So, of course, that's become the go-to mic. When it comes to on the road, the SM series has been used primarily because it's indestructible. And in fact, sure has done a multitude of tests trying to destroy these microphones. For instance, they used it as a hockey puck with the NHL. It was run over by a tour bus. It was shot by a shotgun. It was plunged into a bucket of Guinness. It was thrown in the ocean. It was grilled next to some hot dogs, and every single time came out working. Doesn't look good many times, but it works. So, of course, in the touring business, reliability is number one, and that's a big, big reason why it's still being used 50 years later. So hats off to Shure, hats off to the SM57, SM58, and 50 great years of microphone excellence. My guest today is Jordan DJ Swivel Young, who just mixed the huge Chainsmokers hit Closer. Not only that, he's worked with a number of celebrity hitmakers like Jay-Z and Kanye West, among many others. He's also spent time as Beyoncé's personal engineer and mixed a number of her hits as well. I spoke with Jordan via Skype from his studio in North Hollywood. I want to go back to the beginning with you because I know you started as a musician and then you made the transition to being a DJ, and I want to know more about that. You know, me being a classic kind of engineer, code for old, I have a hard time getting my arms around that, you know, how you make that transition and what the attraction is. So hit me to that. How does that work?
Well, first of all, you said musician, and I would say you're probably taking liberties with the term. I wasn't very good at anything, and I feel like to say you're a musician, you gotta have to be at least decent at something. So basically what it was is when I was growing up, I just played a bunch of instruments. My mom wanted me doing things. I played all kinds of sports. I played every sport. I, you know, was in martial arts and swimming and all kinds of things. And I was interested in music. And so I played a bunch of different instruments. I started with violin in maybe fourth grade or something like that. And, you know, it sounds like nails on a chalkboard when you don't know how to play a violin.
Yeah.
And then I started playing trumpet, and I got okay at that. And then I changed schools, and we had like a way bigger music budget. So I got a bass guitar, and they let me play bass guitar in the school band, like an electric bass. And I got pretty good at that. And sort of that was just like getting me used to just music, just making music and learn, you know, I wasn't very good at any of them. I mean, I could play basic things, you know, like everybody else learns, you learn a few songs and whatever. But what really opened up my eyes to music, like at that time, I didn't know how music was made. I thought, you know, every song you hear on the radio, when you hear a string sound or a horn sound, that there was an orchestra in there, and I had no idea that there was this thing called MIDI and keyboards, and you could, like, one person could program an entire song and it sound, amazing. So I started DJing, and kind of at the same time I started DJing, I went into high school, and I think it was in 10th grade. We had a music class in high school, and I went to a tech school, and the school had, rather than just traditional band or traditional music theory and boring things that most schools would have, we had a recording studio in our school. And we had 25 stations with a little mixer, set of headphones, a Roland keyboard, and a Mac. And the Mac had like a Cubasis on it. So that was where I learned, like, oh wow, I can make a whole beat with this one keyboard. And I can be the drummer, I can be the bass guitarist, I can, you know, play the top line melodies, I can do all that. So that happened at the exact same time that I was learning how to DJ. And I was, you know, DJing opened my ears to just all kinds of different music. I mean, I listen to everything, but when you DJ, you start digging and you get really interested in finding music and being up on the latest and greatest and all that. And at the time, this was like, not pre-internet, but this was like right when MP3s started existing. Like, this was like 2000 99. I mean, I'm sure MP3s are around, but when it was like, this was a Napster era. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So at that time, like, discovering music wasn't as easy as it was today. So when I started DJing, then you spend time trying to find music, like find the newest and coolest. So Yeah, so all that sort of paired and sort of made me just want to do this. Initially I wanted to be a producer, and then my route to being a producer was, well, I should probably learn how to engineer too. So yeah, I don't know. That seemed like a long, convoluted answer to what you wanted, but that was sort of the path. Yeah,
I get it. Okay, so then you went to Full Sail. And
yeah,
what I find that's interesting is there are so many people that go to not only Full Sail, but recording programs in colleges, universities, community colleges, all over the world.
Yeah.
There are so many of them, and very few of them can get gigs because there aren't that many when it's all said and done. So how did you do it?
Yeah. So my thought on this, I mean, you're right. There's like a supply and demand thing, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I found that most people who go to these schools aren't fully committed the way that one needs to be to, I mean, you know, you've worked in music a long time. You really have to be all in,
yeah.
You know, we know this, and it's not easy. And everyone, you know, it's easy when you're on the outside looking in, you sort of see this like glamorous thing, and it's not really all that glamorous. We show up, we work on records and we put in a lot of hours, more than most people. I mean, we're on this 24-hour schedule, at least I was. So, how did I do it? I just wanted it so bad. It never felt like work to me. So I graduated, I moved to New York, and I ended up landing this internship with Duro, and I was at the studio like 100 hours, 120 hours a week, unpaid, and happy to be there, like pumped to be there. So not everybody is prepared to commit that level of effort to their careers. And so when I go back and speak to students at Full Sail or any school for that matter, that's the biggest thing I say is I'm not special. I didn't have some amazing musical gift. I didn't have anything. Honestly, I don't think I'm all that special in any way. I mean, I have so many friends who are just these incredible musicians and just naturally talented and worked hard, of course, as well. But I never had that. So I just busted my ass. I just worked as hard as I possibly could. And so that's what I get across is there is jobs if you're prepared to put in that level of commitment, time, effort, blood, sweat, tears. Yeah. And if you're not, then yeah, you might be a Guitar Center.
You know, I've found that too. And just in general, that when you go to college, post-secondary school of any type, a lot of times what it is you're going to figure out what you don't want to do as much as what you do, because you
could not agree more. Yeah.
You go and then you figure out, well, it's not what I thought, and you sort of eliminate, you know, some things. So that's just as important as going and having the passion, you know, finding your passion immediately. And you were just lucky. And so was I when I first started too, because I had that passion too. Well,
yeah,
hey,
I
anybody in the business
lucky.
Is like that.
Yeah. And by the way, I have an identical twin brother. So, he loved music as much as me in high school, but he didn't pursue music. And it took him about 5 or 6 years. Like, I was already in New York working, and it took him about 5 years. He did a traditional 4-year university education. It took him about 5 years to really figure out he wanted to do real estate development. So, I acknowledge that. I knew what I wanted from the beginning, and I went after that. I didn't have a plan B, no plan C. I just said, music is it. And yeah.
Very cool. Very
and
cool.
So, somebody who was raised and grew up the exact same way as me didn't know. So.
Good case study there, boy.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're working with Duro then. That's where you got your chops, right?
Yeah, learn everything under him. Still one of my closest friends. He, not just about engineering and being in the studio and working with artists, but even just the music business, just life, honestly. Like I look at him as a big brother. I was 20 when I started working for him, or did I just turn 21? Anyways, it was in 2005. I got the job the end of 2005, like December, November. And my first day of work was January 3rd, 2006. So at that time, I mean, yeah, I learned everything about my career, and also just I grew up around him.
Yeah.
In many ways. So, he was sort of the best mentor I could have hoped for, and fortunate to have been able to work with some of my favorite artists. When I left Full Sail, I knew I wanted to work around urban music, hip hop music, and that's what I was listening to. That's the kind of tracks I was making. That's everything that I was doing. And so I made a decision. I need to be in New York for this, not LA. So I opted for the New York path. And looking back now, I mean, he is by far the best person I could have worked for. Even now, if I look back, there's no other job I could have gotten that would have given me the wealth of knowledge and the ability to succeed, the opportunity to succeed. So, I'm super grateful for that.
Well, how did you get the gig with him? Because just finding out that there's an availability, there's an opening, is really difficult. And, you know, just being in the right place at the right time when that opening happens, that's a lot of serendipity there.
Well, there is some serendipity, but Full Sail found me the gig, actually.
Really?
So they have a career development department, and I moved to New York in the beginning of August 2005, and I had already lined up an internship at another studio on the Lower East Side prior, because through a friend I had done some networking, and they were like, yeah, we'll take an internship. So I get to New York, I start working at the studio. They did a lot of jazz music there and other things. Great studio, beautiful space, but just didn't really click with them. And I quit. And I'm Canadian, so I was on a work visa. I had 1 year to figure, an intern visa. So I had like 1 year to figure this thing out. Otherwise, I was back to Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So so quitting was like a risk for me. But I just knew that in my heart, it wasn't where I wanted to be. It wasn't what I wanted to do. So so I quit, and then I just started submitting my resume to everything, and for 2 months there I didn't really have much going on. And then this opportunity with career development at Full Sail, they sent me an email that said, hey, we have this potential job opening, do you want to submit your resume? And I looked it up. I was like, hell yeah, I want to submit my resume. So I did, and a few weeks later I got an email from his assistant at the time saying, hey, just wanted to let you know, just sort of a courtesy, loved your resume, but you mentioned you're a DJ on your resume. And, you know, we've had problems with DJs like music in the past. So unfortunately, we can't take that risk. But this is more a courtesy. I would suggest if you're going to apply to another studio, you should take the DJ off your resume. And that was it. And so I sat on that email for a day and I read it, and in my mind, I was like, no, this is the gig. This is what I need. So I responded eventually, and I just basically begged for an interview. I said, look, I would never leak music. I want this more than anything. Just trust me, meet me. I promise you, you won't be disappointed. And they said, well, unfortunately we filled the position, but if you'd like a tour of the studio, you know, come up. So I came up later that day, or maybe it was the next day. And I got a tour of the space, and I met Duro and his assistant, and it turned into a little impromptu interview, although I still thought that job was filled. So I sort of forced my way into that interview, and then, I thought it went well, but still not expecting anything because the job was filled. So I go home, and then maybe a week later, Duro gives me a call, and he just says, if you want the job, you start top of January, so enjoy your holidays. And I said, all right, see you then. That was it.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
but it just goes to show you that persistence really does count for something, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I always say, like, I'm not one to, if I don't like the answer I get, I usually don't like to settle on it.
Yeah.
So although at the same time, I'm still a good enough read of people where I can not be over the top with it, but you have to fight for what you want in this business. Nobody's going to give it to you. So, yeah, that was sort of what I did.
Okay, you went out as a freelancer pretty quickly, as I understand it. How did that come about?
It was sort of half and half. So I started with Duro in January of 2006. And about the studio was beautiful space in the Film Center in New York, and it was just Duro, his assistant, and me. So Duro would just show up and mix during the day, we'd have recording sessions at night. And basically I would just do all the cleaning and doing all that stuff. 5 months into it, his assistant took a position with another producer. So he left. And of course, like in most cases, I inherited that job. but there wasn't somebody under me. So I was sort of doing everything. I was assisting and I was also cleaning up and doing all that regular stuff too. So, then Fabulous, his Duro's artist, 2 months later was starting to work on the album. Now, over this whole time, 5 months into it, at this point, it's a small space. It's just the two. It was just me and the assistant. So now I'm assisting. I'm setting up microphones. I'm in sessions. I'm watching artists work. I'm seeing how the whole thing works. I'm like doing my own recording sessions at night when I have like, you know, little clients and things like that. Even no money, just hey, come use a space and just more getting experience. And then when Fab started working, I had worked 7 months unpaid, 100 hours a week, and gave everything to that. And I told her, I was like, look, I'm ready. I know how to record a vocal. I can, you know, I can do this. So put me in. So 7 months into my internship, he eventually said, all right, sure, you're up, and sort of threw me in the fire. So I became Fabulous's engineer. And so at that point, I guess that's what you mean why when you say you became freelance pretty quickly. I was getting paid and I was a freelance engineer for Fabulous, but at the same time I was still interning and assisting Duro. Got unpaid.
It. Yeah.
So I would work for Duro unpaid during the day. It was long days. I would show up to the studio at maybe noon. I would work with Duro till 9, and then Fabulous would show up at 9 or 10, and I'd work with him until 6 in the morning. And then I'd go home and sleep for 4 hours and do it again. So yeah. Technically I was freelance, but I was still under Duro.
Yeah.
I didn't fully leave that job until 2009. And I'd say 2009 is when I became entirely freelance, where all of my work was just independent.
And at that point, you felt there's enough work that you could do it and you were pretty safe then. And did you have an agent at that point or a manager or anything? Or
No agent. Sort of had a manager. I've had a number of managers and they all got fired. What I found is I've never had somebody who worked as hard as I worked for me. And I just felt, you know, if I'm going to give up a significant portion of my income to somebody, you've got to work as hard for me as I work for me. Cause that's your job. Your job is to work for me.
Yeah.
So, I was not fortunate enough to find that person, but it was a blessing because over the course of my career, being my own manager, one, I didn't have to give up, you know, 15% or whatever it is. But on top of that, I learned so much about the business. And that's where Duro was really instrumental in teaching me about business. Even just something as simple as taxes.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't teach you taxes in school. So all of that I learned, you know, setting up an LLC and – yeah, that I learned all of that from him because he's really smart when it comes to business and all those things. So, anyways, yeah, I guess 2009, maybe early 2010 is when I became sort of independent. But I was still working with Fabs. I was making money on the Fabulous projects, and then I was starting to get just a lot of. I was becoming the go-to recording guy in New York for any sort of urban R&B pop stuff. And I was getting all these gigs and it wasn't really one artist. It was like, you know, 2 days here with this person, 4 days here with this person, 1 day here with this person. Just that became a steady income. And it wasn't like a huge amount of money, but it was enough for me to comfortably live in New York and not have to worry about, you know, my rent.
That's hard in itself.
Yeah, of course. And then of course, like everything, it snowballs. You build your client base and shortly after so 2009, shortly after kind of really what made me leave Duro was just I got so busy I just couldn't assist them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't have the time to do it. And then a few months after that, maybe 6 months after that, I became Beyonce's engineer. And then at that point, it's like, you don't have a life. You're done.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you're getting hired to record. Were you also doing mixing at the time?
Okay, so yes, my first professional mix was, and this goes back to, a few questions ago when we were talking about sort of not really not taking no for an answer, just for, asking for what you want. And so I was Fabulous's engineer. We started the album in it was July of 2006 was when we started the record. So that was 7 months into my internship, my first real paid gig from a record label, properly paid. We spent a year on that album. So we get to the end of the album, and obviously Duro is legendary mix engineer, so he mixes all of his stuff. And I was assisting those mixes. We were at Sony Studios, and there was two mixes left. And so he said, "All right, set up this mix." It was late one day. He finished one. He said, "Set up this mix. I'll be in the morning to start it." So I said, "Okay, cool." So I set up, and at this point, I'd seen him mix 100 songs, 200 songs already. I was like, "I could do this. I could figure this one out." So I stayed all night and I mixed the record for him. And he showed up in the morning. He was a little confused why I was still there. And I just said, "I mixed the record. Take a listen to it." So he listened to it, and then he like asked me to go get him a sandwich or something like that, and he continued mixing it. Obviously, I didn't do the best job, but I wasn't discouraged. And there was one more song left, and so that night he finished mixing that the song that I tried to mix, and he said, "All right, set up this last one, and I'll be in the morning to mix it." So I stayed that night too. I set it up, and then I stayed that night and I mixed that one as well, and then he listened to it and he made a couple little tweaks, but. And then we never really talked about it again after that, but the album got finished. And then when the album came out, he gave me the mix credit. So that was my first like major label mix. And then he allowed me to co-mix the entire next Fabulous album with him, Loso's Way. So that was From Nothing to Something. And then 2 years later, we did Loso's Way in 2009. And I recorded that whole project and then co-mixed that whole project with him. And yeah, at that point I was doing mixes. I wasn't getting a lot of label mixes, but I was getting, the independent stuff that was coming around. Every once in a while I get like a label mix. And yeah, it wasn't really until I finished with Beyoncé where I made a decision like I'm only going to mix now. I don't really want to record.
And
And
why?
that
What
was
brought that on?
2011.
I mean, I know what why I would do it, but tell me what.
Yeah, well, for a number of reasons. One, I have a very alpha personality. I like to be in control of all situations. And when you're a recording engineer, you're not really in control. You are there to support the artist's vision. You are there to support the artist, just their creative output. And that means showing up when they want you to show up, leaving when they ask you to leave, and just doing as you're told. And that's cool and that's nice, and I learned a lot from that, but generally speaking, I like to be the one in control of the situation. So as a mixer, you have a lot more control of the situation. People come to you because they respect what you do and your ear, and that gives you a lot of freedom with many clients. And so for me, it was more about the personal freedom. I could show up to the studio when I wanted. I could mix when I wanted. I could take as much or as little time as I wanted. The only thing that mattered was the end result. So if I got to a great end result in 1 hour, great. If it took me 12 hours, all right, doesn't make a difference. But I was in control of that situation. So that's really why. And then, of course, financially speaking, there's just better money. And it's for me, creatively speaking, it's more creative. I get to do what I want. And at this point as a mixer, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but even like with the Chainsmokers stuff and a lot of the things that I mix now, I don't go into it as from the perspective of a mixer. I go into it from the perspective of a producer. I am the first person to change a kick drum. Like, don't come to me for a mix if you don't want my opinion, because you're going to get it. And so I'm the first to swap out drums. I'm the first to replay a bass. If I feel like it needs a part, I'll add a part. Like, I don't care, because at the end of the day, I want the best result. And I'm not, there's no ego involved. If you don't like what I do, I'll remove it, no problem. But I feel like people have started coming to me because they trust my ear and trust my vision and know that I'm willing to take it that next step. What I find mixing is about taking a record from 90% to 100%. And that last 10% isn't just about getting the frequency right on the drums or the bass or whatever. It's about finishing a record. That could be arrangement, that could be drum program, it could be a lot of different things. And so that's how that was the freedom of being able to create like that is a big thing for me. So that's why I started mixing.
I always felt the same way, where there's so much production involved when it comes to mixing, and I think that's always overlooked, because really you have control over the arrangement at that point. What's in the mix, what's out of the mix, and how the mix is developing in intensity. I mean, that's all under your control, and it's the most important thing when it's all said and done, because if you don't have a good arrangement, and again, you're controlling that, if you don't have a good arrangement, then the song is not going to work. So
I totally right.
Know where you're coming from. Definitely.
Totally right. And I mean, you know, it goes so far using Closer, the Chainsmokers record that been doing really well this year. So when I mix that, I'm actually singing on that song.
Really?
Not the lead vocal, background vocals, but not for any other reason than during the mix, I was like, oh, it's missing this one little harmony part that we should add. And so I just set up a mic and I recorded it myself. And I sent the mix back and I said, hey, listen, I added some vocals to the song. I know that sounds crazy. Just take a listen. If you don't like it, I'll take it out. And they listened to it and they're like, this sounds awesome. Like, yeah, we're keeping it for sure. So that was a bit of a risk. I felt like I was able to, there was enough comfort level with those guys where I could do that. And it worked out well. So at this point now, I'm sort of no holds barred. I do whatever is needed to finish a record. And most clients are really open to that. And I have that conversation with them ahead of time.
Well, let's go to Closer for a second, because that is something that I wanted to talk to you about. It's an interesting song in that it seems fairly sparse when you listen to it, but when you start to dig down, there's a lot going on.
I'm
just curious, what was that mix like? How large was it, and what did you have to do with it? Because once again, it sounds one way with the very superficial listening, and as you go deeper and you really start to focus, it's something else completely.
Yeah, I mean, it built. There's a lot of build-ups. There's a lot of dropouts. The verse is incredibly sparse. It's a kick drum and a snap and one little chord thing. And of course, a vocal. So that song came. Normally, the process that I have with the Chainsmokers is they will give me a song. I will start the mix, and then Drew will come in, and we will finish it together. And I find you get the best results that way, because when the producer's in the room and you can start throwing ideas around, you basically take the whole mix and you throw it at the wall, and only the best ideas are going to stick.
Yeah.
And I ended up mixing. We mixed that song 3 times, by the way. A lot of work went into that mix. And, the vocals change and lots of things change over the course of that record. There's a lot of elements in it, but they're nuance sort of elements, right? There's little things that you really have to dig in and sort of listen to and analyze to really hear all the different elements. But
that's what keeps it interesting, though.
Yeah, of course. We struggled like so long with like the kick drum and the bass and how they sort of live together and work together. We changed the sound on it like a few times. It was a fun mix to do. And then of course, like adding the vocals at the end and it's just one of those songs that, I had no idea it was going to be what it was going to be. I just thought it was a catchy pop song and something different than what was on the radio at the time. And then I guess everyone else sort of agreed.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, definitely. It's a fun ride once you get something like that. That's for sure. Very cool.
Yeah. Very unexpected. And just sort of gained this life of its own, which is really cool. So glad to be a part of it.
When you're mixing, you're not doing it in the box, are you? How much are, well, let's, let me just put it another way. How much are you doing in the box?
Everything.
Oh, you are
in the box.
Okay.
I have mixed records on airplanes. I have mixed records, you know, anywhere. Doesn't matter. I have my laptop, I have my iLock, I have my headphones. I can mix anywhere. So yeah, everything's in the box. And I've never really been outside the box. When I was at Duro Studio and we had a full studio, every once in a while I would I would process vocals through maybe a distressor or something like that. I'd use some outboard gear. But for the most part, yeah, just stayed in the box. I just found it to be more convenient. And at this point, plugins sound so good. Yeah, I'm not too picky about it. I'm not a gear guy. I'm unlike many engineers. I'm not a gear guy at all. I really don't care about gear.
Yeah.
Gear is not interesting to me. Gear that does something interesting is interesting to me, but I don't care about a compressor.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. I care about getting a great mix. And I can do that with any compressor. I can do that with any EQ. To me, 90% of a mix is balance and imaging.
Yeah.
So where does it sit left, right? Where does it sit up, down volume? And then the rest of it is corrective EQing. And then, you know, it's only about 10% effects and cool things and the sprinkles, what I call them. So, to me, I don't need a whole lot as far as gear. I need a good channel strip, and that gets most of what I need done.
Yeah, it's funny. I always felt the same way, where I don't care what kind of gear studio has or, you know, what you have in terms of plugins. It's like, oh, okay, an EQ is an EQ. We'll make it work somehow, make this work where it has to. They all do
exactly
pretty much the same thing. So it never bothered me when there was something not there or it was there or whatever. It's like, well, okay, whatever.
Yeah, and we're all creatures of habit. So eventually you get, I get used to certain plugins and I'm like, I like this. It's not because I think it sounds better than this one. It might even sound worse than this one. But the point is, I know it and I know exactly how to use it really quickly. And it's sort of become just intuitive. And I don't have to look at it.
Okay.
So that's my reason for using particular plugins, because I'm quick on them.
Yeah. Okay. I get that. So what are they? What are your go-to plugins?
My go-to is honestly, an SSL, channel strip, the Waves SSL.
Mm-hmm.
I use, on vocals, I use the RDSer, generally speaking. I use, an Arvox, just basic, simple compressor. What else? I love the SPL Vitalizer. The plugin version, and I like that. It just adds a nice, sometimes if I want a nice little shine on something, the stereo imaging tool on it, like the spreader tool on it, is great. The bass, you can carve out interesting bass frequencies with it. That's like my sort of my little toy plugin. And I use Lexicon Reverbs, the Lexicon Reverb bundle. Love that stuff. And that's like it. I mean, I love the Soundtoys stuff. Soundtoys stuff sounds great. But that's kind of like, that's like it. I use the Wave stuff, and yeah.
Now, you just said that you mixed on airplanes, and as long as you have a good set of headphones, you're happy. So what are you using to mix on phones, and do you feel confident that that's going to translate?
I know it's going to translate, because even when I'm in the studio, I throw the headphones on.
Okay. Fair enough.
I use Sennheiser HD 650s, and they are a dream. I also have the Sennheiser HD 800s, which I don't know if you've ever seen those, but they're like the pinnacle of, I don't think there's a better headphone on the planet than those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use them generally speaking, because they are so accurate that they really show the flaws in a mix. So I try to use those sparingly. But the HD 650s feel as close to monitors as any headphone can be. And the clarity is incredible, but it's not over the top bright on the top. There's got good low end response. Those have been my secret weapon for years. And I have great monitors too. Like, I mix on monitors, of course, but I like to go back and forth because there's, you get something interesting when you listen on headphones and you don't have, like, I'm just off a duet, so I don't have like a headphone mix thing where you get like some cross bleed and things like that. When you have a completely isolated sound left and right, you hear the mix differently. And so I jump back and forth between speakers and headphones to make sure that I'm not missing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want it to sound one way when you're in headphones and a different way in monitors. So I use that as a tool to just make sure I'm making the right decisions.
Do you listen on a set of crappy speakers as well, or walk out of the room or something like that? Is there any other mix trick?
No, not really, honestly. I know some people like to do that, and I know there's a reason for it, but I think really what that translates to is, do you know your speakers? Mm. And I know my speakers. So I use Genelex and the 8350 ones, and they've been an absolute dream for me. And I know my speakers really well. I know my headphones really well. I know how it's going to translate to small speakers. I do have a pair of Flare audio speakers that are small that I'll listen to sometimes. But yeah, I mean, it's not really, it's not a requirement for me to have NS10s. Yeah.
Or, like,
or
to hear that.
Tones or, yeah.
Okay. What's your approach to a mix then? How would you start a mix? And let's say you're mixing for a client that you had nothing to do with the tracking. Would you listen to the rough mix, or do you just go in cold?
I used to just go in cold, and that worked for a time. But now I found that producers, especially when I get songs now, I mean, the production level is so much higher now. It's from when it was, when I was looking at mixes that Duro was getting 10 years ago, it's just a different level, especially these EDM DJs and things like that. I mean, these guys are pros. These guys are so good. And most of these producers are mixing along the way. And so they've made a lot of creative decisions to get to that rough, to get to that demo. And at this point, it just makes a lot more sense to build off of the demo because there was a lot of work done. But every once in a while, I'll get a client who says, look, we're not married to this demo at all. We, you know, trust me, just start from scratch, do your own thing. And I love that. That gives me this amazing freedom. But yeah, most of the time now I'm working off a demo. But there, I've yet to be in a situation where I felt like I couldn't improve on a demo.
Mm-hmm.
and make it sound better. So especially like with vocals, I mean, I spend half of my mixes are spent working and tweaking vocals. So,
and what are you tweaking?
Yeah. For me, vocals about, well, one, getting the right EQ curve. I find that a lot of producers over EQ a vocal almost. They kind of do too much to it. And so I usually find that I end up dialing back and doing really simple things with a vocal. And then I spend a ton of time on vocal rides. Like manually riding a fader, or sometimes it's with clip gain and other things like that, but manually riding a fader it's not just about leveling everything out, that's part of it, but it's also like, I'll do things like on the tail of a note, if a note rings out, a vocal note, I'll have it crescendo at the end. And there's like, you know, what you can ride a vocal to make it, it really has to flow with the beat.
Yeah.
And so that I spend a lot of time, you know, making sure every syllable hits at the right volume. The ends of words, sometimes I want to ride those up so that they have like a little more impact, and it almost feels like it just helps them flow into the next word better. It's hard to really describe, but I just know when my ear hears it, I know when a vocal is just sort of sitting there, and then I know when it's like glued in.
Yeah.
And that takes just time. That's just hours of you know, writing vocal.
Yeah, sounds like it, definitely. So you're doing it all via a fader then, or a mouse on fader, or are you drawing it in?
The mouse sucks. Drawing it in sucks. When I was under Duro and I really learned how to do vocal rides, we had an Icon. And so, of course, we had a million faders that we could just auto-assign and program. Generally speaking, I'm just, because I work off my laptop most of the time now, I'm just really good with clip gain.
Mm.
So I'll just do the clip gain. And then, you could do really interesting things with that, because you can just, if you want the end of a word to just be much louder, you can raise that by like 6 dB and then just do a crossfade, and it'll give you that crescendo you want, as opposed to having to draw it in.
Yeah.
So, but I'm in the process of like sort of redoing my little home studio setup. So I think I'm going to pick up maybe one of those Avid docks, just so I have one fader. That's all I need, is one fader, honestly.
Yeah, right, right. So,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the dock is nice, I have to say. It's one of the nicest things they've made in a long time.
Most useful. I wish you didn't have to buy an iPad, though. Like, you got to buy the dock, and then you also have to buy an iPad, which is not cheap. So it'd be nice if they did one with a built-in screen.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Oh, okay, how about sort of a philosophical question here. Modern mixes are very different than the mixes that we did in the past, even 10 years ago. What do you attribute that to?
I just think the production tools have changed. The way that people produce music has changed. People are less reliant on physical gear now than they were. And I'm generally speaking here, of course, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at most of the producers coming up are starting as like these EDM DJ type producer guys. And, you know, they get Ableton, they get a ton of plugins, and they just go to town. And also you have YouTube around, which is a huge resource for production techniques and tools and tips and tricks and all these sort of things that you didn't really have 10 years ago. I mean, where did you go for that? You had to be mentored by somebody who had the tips and tricks to learn that sort of stuff, you know. So in the YouTube era, you can learn anything in 5 seconds. And so I think that has enabled people to really grow their tool belt, right?
Yeah.
I think you just have every tool in the world. There's a million plugins and then a million ways to use them all. And there's all kinds of resources on how to do that. So I find that people just they just have more options. They have more options. And with more options, you can do more things.
Now, see, the way I see it is that the sound of modern mixes has everything to do with automation, because you can automate so much more, and people do.
So yes.
There's a slickness that you get that you never had before, because you are doing what you just said with your vocal, where you're writing the releases of a vocal, of a phrase, of a word, where you could never do that before and never even thought about doing. But just those things make a big difference to me anyway.
Yeah, and then automating plugins now. I mean, computers are so much faster. You can have 100 tracks with automation on it, and it's not going to choke up the way that old Pro Tools systems might have.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day. So, I couldn't agree more with that. And now you get these production sessions where someone's automating, you know, a delay return, the pans on a delay return, but then automating a filter on that so that it opens up and then just closes at this one beat. And then, there's all kinds of different things that you can do. And people take advantage of that. So
one last question before I'll let you go. Well, a couple actually before I let you go, because I know you're busy and I really appreciate your time, Jordan. Let's talk about Beyonce, because you were with her for what, 4 years, 3 years?
No, I was with her for about 2 years.
2 years. Okay.
So I did one whole album with her. I did a couple DVDs with her. And then some of what we did on the album made it to the next album. So I basically worked on two albums with her. Yeah.
I've read interviews with you where you were saying about how difficult it was, the pace, because she was always working and everything was at a very fast pace and you were expected to do things quickly.
Very.
When you were cutting tracks with her, what did the tracks consist of usually? And what I mean is, were they electronic based? Were there musicians involved? Were they cutting traditional tracks sometimes? How did that work?
We had a lot of musicians involved. So I did the 4 album, which was sort of a departure for her in some ways from what she was normally doing. And we experimented a lot on that album. We had, bands come in. Musicians. We had the Fela Kuti band from Broadway come in for a few days, which was really cool. 22-piece band, and we just tracked a ton of stuff with them, and then we would have a piano player come in, we'd have guitarists come in and bass players and lots of live drums and horn sections, string sections. Yeah, we did everything on that record. Obviously there's a ton of programming involved, and we used the live stuff as accents, as just nice little sprinkles to just add layers and textures and things like that. So when I was talking about the pace with her, I guess the point is she has every resource at her disposal. And so if she wants live drums, we're doing live drums. And it's like the drummer will be called and will show up in an hour, and you got to be set up and ready to go. And really, all this can happen at the spur of a moment. We could be working on a song, and the producer might come in. Shea Taylor at the time was doing a lot of the production. He might come in and say, "Oh man, this could use some live drums." B would be like, "All right, cool, let's do it." Like right now, are we gonna, do we have a drummer? We'll figure it out. And she called her drummer from tour. Drummer would show up within an hour, and we'd be cutting drums. And so, the pace is pretty. She doesn't really like to take a lot of breaks. So you always have to be ready. You're always sort of got to be, on the ball, ready to go. She doesn't really understand the limitations of the technology so much. So if she wants to do it, we're going to figure it out.
Yeah,
for sure. So you learn a lot. You learn how to be very efficient in those scenarios.
I was going to say, that's a really good education. For me,
the best.
It was
by far the best.
It was something similar, but in a completely different vein, where it was cutting commercials, where you had 3 hours to do everything. First hour you were tracking, second hour you're doing the overdubs, all of them. And the third hour you were mixing, and then it was out the door.
You learn very quickly if you take a little too much time on that 1 hour, you're not finishing. So
yeah. And it's all union, so it has to happen within that time period, and it's just crazy. But there's nothing better in terms of an education on how to get things done and how to get things done quickly, but even better, how to trust your intuition on something, because instead of just sitting there and thinking, well, I don't know what to do, you just do it, which I'm sure you're good at now.
Yeah, you have to figure it out. I mean, our job as producers, as engineers, as mixers, is to deliver the product. And so you have to work around your clients. You have to work around time constraints, budget restraints, all these things. And so your job is to, weed through all the noise and just get it done. And so working with someone like her, where it's so unpredictable, every day is unpredictable. When I walk into a session with her, I have no idea what we're going to work on. None. So it's literally whatever she feels like doing. And that could be writing a new song. It could be working on an old song from 6 months ago. Could be any number of things. You just got to be ready to go. So
I'd say that's fun, actually.
It's a ton of fun, and it's the best learning experience, and it made me a much better engineer for it. And I learned a lot about the music business. I learned a lot about people and about, especially working around her, there's a large team of people, and you sort of get every different personality in the world. And so you just learn about, that was, that added to my education with Duro was like, gave me everything I needed to be able to get into that situation. And then she just leveled me up so much. Yeah.
Last question, Jordan. And I think you kind of already answered this, but maybe not. What was the one piece of advice that you got? Was there one piece of advice that you either got or something that you figured out along the way that was like the light came on and was like, okay, now I get it. Maybe it was business advice, maybe it was music advice, but was there something, one piece that was just like the overwhelming mantra for you?
The best piece of advice, I don't know if it was advice or just learning through, I mean, certainly I've heard it before, but I also learned it on my own, is in this business, you can't really just do one thing. You can, but it's risky. So I try not to put all my eggs in one basket anymore. You know, if you're working, for example, if your gig is with one artist and your entire sort of financial, all your income is based off of one artist. Well, if something, you have this risk that if something happens to that artist, they want to take a break, they want to go on tour, they want to do any of these other things, you're sort of on your own. So, and then beyond just that, take that a step further. And I've learned that, you know, you can't just do one, you need multiple income streams, especially in music. And there's so many opportunities. And so I've sort of diversified just from being a audio professional, a producer, a mixer, to, you know, I started a tech company and I started a magazine and they're all based in music. But, first of all, it gives me its new creative outlets, to use and it's new business opportunities as well. So, and they sort of play off of each other. So, I started a magazine called Headliner Magazine with my friend Paul Watson in the UK, and we have this amazing platform now that we have a ton of sponsors and we get a lot of great content. We have our next issue has Ricky Gervais is on the cover, and yeah, we're doing some great things with that. And and then my tech company is called Skio Music, SKIOmusic.com, and what we've aimed to do there is we've created a social platform where you can do deals with other musicians. So we started with remix deals and we wanted to take the complexity of the music business out of making music for your average musician. So if now you make music differently, right? Kids make music differently. They find acapellas, they find samples, they chop it up and they make remixes and whatever. Yeah. And then they post it on their social media accounts and illegally. They don't know that. They're not trying to monetize it, but it's just the way that music is made now. It's completely different. And so we wanted to solve that problem. How do we allow people to make music the way that they want to make music, but do it legally? And so we created Skio, and you can go to the platform. You can sign up. You can find a song that you like. You can hit remix. And in most cases, there's a prefabricated deal where you can just pay $10 or in many cases free, and you can just download the stems. And you can work directly with that artist or directly with that record label and upload your content. You have a deal with them. You have a legal agreement and you have the rights to post it to your social accounts. And you can also negotiate deals. And we've simplified the whole negotiating process so that you don't need a manager or a lawyer to do it. You're negotiating three or four important points. How much am I getting paid? What's the royalty? What's the delivery date? What's my credit? That's it. And then that funnels into a full legal document that is written by the best attorneys in the music business that we made sure was written with the purpose of being fair for both parties. So there's no, it doesn't lean in any party's favor. It's just fair. So we created this platform and it's been going really well.
That's one of the coolest things I've heard about in a long time, I have to say. Congratulations on that. It makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
You know, I get hit with press releases, with people calling me, with all sorts of ideas for startups, for music social networks, music ideas online, and most of them you have to scratch your head about. This one is cool, I have to say. This one,
thank you.
I really hope that something big happens with it because it serves a niche and it's very cool. Congratulations.
Yeah. I mean, thank you. It's been going really well. And yeah, our whole thing, like I said, is take the business out of music for your average producer or remixer who doesn't have a manager, doesn't have those resources. well, we handle your legal, we handle your payments, we handle your file transfer, and we handle your communication. All of that in one centralized place. And there's also, you know, the discovery side of it. We have a ton of content and remix contests and all these great partners. And yeah, so I encourage anybody who's listening, go check it out, skiomusic.com, skiomusic.com.
To find out more about Jordan, go to djswivel.com. That's DJSWIVEL, djswivel.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.